Welcome to your show. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is live right now.
Welcome to 2A Radio and a day dedicated to Independence Day. The original liberties which came to people from the English-speaking world came in the form of the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta was also referred to as the Magna Carta Liberarum, the Great Charter of Freedoms, in an English legal charter, originally issued in the year of 1215. It was written in Latin and is known by its Latin name. The usual English translation of Magna Carta is Great Charter. Magna Carta required King John of England to proclaim certain rights pertaining to freedom, respect certain legal procedures, and accept that his will could not be bound by the law. It explicitly protected certain rights of the king's subjects, whether free or fettered, and implicitly supported what became the writ of habeas corpus, allowing appeal against unlawful imprisonment. Magna Carta was arguably the most significant early influence in the extensive historical process that led to the rule of constitutional law today in the English-speaking world. Magna Carta influenced the development of the common law and many constitutional documents, including the United States Constitution. Many clauses were renewed throughout the Middle Ages and continued to be renewed as late as the 18th century. By the second half of the 19th century, however, most clauses in their original form had been repealed from English law. Magna Carta was the first document forced onto an English king by a group of his subjects, the barons, in an attempt to limit his power by law and protect their privileges. It was preceded by the 1100 Charter of Liberties, in which King Henry I voluntarily stated that his own powers were under the law. In practice, Magna Carta in the medieval period did not limit the power of kings, but by the time the English Civil War, it had become an important symbol for those who wished to show that the king was bound by the law. This was transgendered into the Declaration of Independence, which then went through the Constitutional Congress and was written into the Constitution of the United States, to limit the powers of the government and allow all of the rights of the people to be recognized as inalienable. No other country in the world had such a group of men as the men who wrote the Declaration of Independence commit such a treasonous act as to limit the power of their king, dispose of that power over them, and allow all of the powers to be vested within the people of their own nation. At no other time had any other country experienced such a feat. Now, just a short bit of actually how it went down within the chambers in Philadelphia when they were voting to decide who was going to join in and be a signer onto that Declaration of Independence.
That these colonies are, and of a right ought to be, free and independent states, and that all political connection between them and the country of Great Britain is, and of a right ought to be, totally dissolved.
New Hampshire.
New Hampshire.
Votes yes.
Rhode Island.
Rhode Island votes yes.
Massachusetts.
Massachusetts votes yes.
New York.
New York has yet to receive new instructions from its constituent assembly. We therefore respectfully abstain.
Connecticut.
Connecticut votes yes.
New Jersey.
New Jersey votes yes.
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania votes yes.
Delaware.
Delaware votes yes.
Virginia.
Virginia votes yes.
Maryland.
Maryland votes yes.
North Carolina.
North Carolina
votes yes.
South Carolina.
South Carolina votes yes.
Georgia.
Georgia votes yes.
The vote stands. 12-4 independents. None against. With one abstention. Resolution carries.
Very shortly after that, we went into the American Revolution. Commonly referred to as the Second American Revolution was the War of 1812. During the War of 1812, Francis Scott Key was accompanied by the American prisoner exchange agent Colonel John Stuart Skinner. They dined aboard the British ship HMS Tonnant as the guests of three British officers, Vice Admiral Alexander Crony, Rear Admiral Sir George Cockburn, and Major General Robert Ross. Skinner and Key were there to negotiate the release of a prisoner, Dr. William Beans. Beans was a resident of Upper Marlboro, Maryland, and had been captured by the British after he placed rowdy stranglers under citizen's arrest within a group of men. Skinner, Key, and Barnes were allowed to return to their own sloop, but were not allowed to return to Baltimore because they had been familiar with the strength and position of the British units and with the British intent to attack Baltimore. As a result of this, Key was unable to do anything but watch the bombarding of the American forces at Fort McHenry during the Battle of Baltimore on the night of September 13th and 14th, 1814. When the smoke cleared, Key was able to see an American flag still waving. On the way back to Baltimore, he was inspired to write the poem describing his experience, The Defense of Fort McHenry, which he published in The Patriot on September 20th, 1814. He intended to fit the rhymes of composer John Stafford Smith to An Ancestrian in Heaven. It became better known as the Star-Spangled Banner under his name. The song was adopted as the American national anthem, first by executive order of Woodrow Wilson in 1916, and then officially by a congressional resolution in 1931, signed by President Herbert Hoover. Talk about the revolution. It's the Independence Day. Let freedom.
So proudly we hail at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly Star Spangled
one of the finest renditions of the national anthem I have ever heard, performed by Carrie Underwood at the 2005 Super Bowl. So perfectly performed. In fact, you heard roughly 80,000 people chiming in with her until she hit that unbelievable high note. A history of the American flag I'm going to share with you now. For more than two centuries, the American flag has been our nation's symbol of freedom and independence. Since Betsy Ross sewed the first American flag in May of 1777, it has represented those values in every town and city in America, in nations around the world, and even in space. Here's a look at the historical development of the American flag. First, in May of 1777, the Continental Congress visited seamstress Betsy Ross's store and asked her to sew the first American flag. June 14th of that year, the Continental Congress passed the first Flag Act to establish an official flag for the nation. Resolved that the flag of the United States be made of 13 stripes alternating red and white, that the Union be 13 stars, white in a field of blue, representing a new constellation. July 4th, 1777, the birth of a new nation was heralded as the Declaration of Independence was read aloud again. January 13th, 1794, Congress passed an act providing for 15 stripes and 15 stars to appear on the flag. April 4th of 1818, Congress passed an act providing for the addition of one star for each state admitted to the Union. The flag was to be changed on the 4th of July following the admission. June 24th, 1912, President Taft signed an executive order providing that the stars be ordered in six horizontal rows and eight stars in each row. Each star was to have a single point facing up. The additional star reflected the admission of America's 48th state, Arizona, into the Union. January 3rd of 1959, President Eisenhower signed an executive order providing that the stars be ordered in seven horizontal rows of seven stars each to reflect the admission of America's 49th and 50th states, Alaska and Hawaii, into the Union. August 21, 1959, President Eisenhower signed an executive order providing that the stars be ordered in nine staggered horizontal rows and 11 staggered vertical rows.
We'll be right back.
Now I've got a little tidbit about the American flag from Johnny Cash.
I walked through a county courthouse square. On a park bench, an old man was sitting there. I said, "Your old courthouse is kind of run down." He said, "No, it'll do for our little town." I said, "Your old flagpole has leaned a little bit, and that's a ragged old flag you got hanging on it." He said, "Have a seat." And I sat down. "Is this the first time you've been to our little town?" I said, "I think it is." He said, "I don't like to brag, but we're kind of proud of that ragged old flag. You see, we got a little hole in that flag there when Washington took it across the Delaware. And it got powder burned the night that Francis Scott Key said, watching it right and say, can you see? And it got a bad rip in New Orleans with Pakenham and Jackson tugging at its seams. And it almost fell at the Alamo beside the Texas flag, but she waved on, though. She got cut with a sword at Chancellorsville, and she got cut again at Shiloh Hill. There was Robert E. Lee, Beauregard, and Bragg, and the south wind blew hard on that ragged old flag. On Flanders Field in World War I, she got a big hole from a Bertha gun. She turned blood red in World War II. She hung limp and low a time or two. She was in Korea, Vietnam. She went where she was sent by her Uncle Sam. She waved from our ships upon the briny foam, and now they've about quit waving back here at home. In her own good land here, she's been abused. She's been burned, dishonored, denied, and refused. And the government for which she stands is scandalized throughout the land. And she's getting threadbare and she's wearing thin, but she's in good shape for the shape she's in. Cause she's been through the fire before, and I believe she can take a whole lot more. So we raise her up every morning, we take her down every night, we don't let her touch the ground, and we fold her upright. On second thought, I do like to brag, cause I'm mighty proud of that ragged old flag.
When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new gods for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having indirect objects, the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. He has refused his assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance. Unless suspended in their operation, till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people, unless those people would relinquish their right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records, for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people. He has refused for a long time, after such dissolutions, to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative power, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migration hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of land. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has kept among us, in times of peace, standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation, for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states, for cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies, for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our government, for suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burned our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the work of death, desolation, and tyranny already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation. He has constrained our fellow citizens, taken captive on the high seas, to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands. He has excited domestic insurrections among us, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an indistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity. And we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They too have been deaf to the voice of justice and of consanguinity. We must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends. We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of a right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
Like trouble, but if it came along, everyone that knew him knew each side that he'd be on. He never was a hero for this county's shining light, but you could always find him standing up for what he thought was right. He'd say, "You've got."
Independence Day is our national holiday commemorating the signing of the Declaration of Independence by the Continental Congress on July 4, 1776, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. At the time of the signing, the U.S. consisted of 13 colonies under the rule of England's King George III. There was growing unrest in the colonies concerning the taxes that had been paid to England. This was commonly referred to as taxation without representation. As the colonists did not have any representation in the English Parliament and had no say in what went on. As the unrest grew in the colonies, King George sent extra troops to help control any rebellion. In 1774, the 13 colonies sent delegates to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to form the First Continental Congress. The delegates were unhappy with England, but were not yet ready to declare war. In April 1775, as the king's troops advanced on Concord, Massachusetts, Paul Revere would sound the alarm that the British are coming, the British are coming, as he rode his horse through the late night streets. The Battle of Concord and its shot heard around the world would mark the unofficial beginning of the colony's War of Independence. The following May, the colonies again sent delegates to the Second Constitutional Congress. For almost a year, the Congress tried to work out its differences with England, again without formally declaring war. By June 1776, their efforts had become hopeless, and a committee was formed to compose a formal Declaration of Independence. Headed by Thomas Jefferson, the committee included John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Robert R. Livingston, and Roger Sherman. Thomas Jefferson was chosen to write the first draft, which was presented to the Congress on June 28th. After various changes, a vote was taken late in the afternoon of July 4th. To make it official, John Hancock, president of the Continental Congress, signed the Declaration of Independence. It is said that John Hancock signed his name with great flourish so King George could read it without spectacles. The following day, copies of the Declaration were distributed. The first newspaper to print the Declaration was the Pennsylvania Evening Post on July 6, 1776. On July 8th, the Declaration had its first public reading in Philadelphia's Independence Square. Twice that day, the Declaration was read to cheering crowds and pealing church bells. Even the bell in Independence Hall was rung. The Providence Bell would later be renamed the Liberty Bell after its encryption. Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto its inhabitants thereof. And although the signing of the Declaration was not complete until August, the 4th of July has been accepted as the official anniversary of the United States independence. The first Independence Day celebration took place the following year, July 4th, 1777. By the early 1800s, the traditions of parades, picnics, and fireworks were established as the way to celebrate America's birthday. And although fireworks have been banned in most places because of the danger, most towns and cities usually have big fireworks displays for all to see and enjoy. 56 men signed the Declaration of Independence, thus committing, arguably, the single most treasonous act against the throne of England in hundreds of years. Considering what's been happening within the United States over the past several decades, I'm going to have for you now the Declaration of Independence of 2008.
A 2008 Declaration of Independence. When in the course of human events, unattended grievances make it necessary for citizens to re-examine the structure of their government and bring about change. We were once a great nation created by immigrants from foreign lands who populated a bountiful continent. We now witness our nation's prestige and our domestic liberties considerably diminished. We who suffer the consequences of a dysfunctional system of government seek to reaffirm our founding principles and to improve upon the structure of representative government. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all human beings are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To secure these rights, government is instituted in society, deriving its just powers from the consent of the governed. However, if a government controlled by special interests becomes unconcerned with the public's well-being and destructive of the people's rights, it is the duty of the people to change that government to provide security and happiness for its citizens. The malevolent, corrupting power of money and the body politic has caused repeated injuries to the public interest. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a suffering nation and a disillusioned world. The presidency and the Congress are steeped in a cult of secrecy that denies the people knowledge of what their government is doing to them and to others in their name. Secrecy is the foremost destructive force to democracy. The presidency and the Congress have failed after the oil shock of 30 years ago to provide leadership to end our dependency on oil. Continued reliance on oil distorts our foreign policy and causes Americans to disproportionately pollute the environment. The presidency and the Congress have been complicit in permitting a small, rapacious, greedy minority of money managers and corporate titans to manipulate the United States and global financial markets for their selfish gain. The presidency and the Congress have redefined the criminal act of terrorism as an act of war in order to maintain the nation in a constant state of war, which in the words of James Madison is the worst of all evils, in that it facilitates the control of the many by the few. The presidency and the Congress have obstructed the administration of justice by refusing the right of habeas corpus to fellow human beings, regardless of national origin, and by transporting them to secret prisons in foreign countries to be tortured and held without knowledge of their crimes or their accusers. The presidency and the Congress have plundered our treasury to fund unnecessary and illegal wars and foreign military adventures based on lies and misinformation. The presidency and the Congress wage psychological war on their citizens to induce unfounded and unreasonable fear of non-existing threats in order to militarize America's culture and make us accept ludicrous defense expenditures greater than all the rest of the world combined, when in fact there is no nation capable or desirous of threatening our security. The presidency and the Congress, in pursuit of an illogical war on drugs, export military weapons that violently destabilize foreign democracies. Their war on drugs ravages America's inner cities, destroys families of our most disadvantaged citizens, and put more of its own citizens in prison than any country in the world. The presidency and the Congress encourages and funds our self-appointed role as the world's policeman, becoming the basis for American imperialism and for distorting our nation's budget priorities with excessive spending for the military-industrial complex. In every electoral contest, Americans vote for change, yet real change is never realized. Despite creative advances in the private sector of human society, our public sector government is mired in partisan stalemate, unable to respond to the complex demands of the 21st century. The political structures of our current representative democracy were designed in the 18th century and are not susceptible to change. Therefore, we citizens of the United States, in our capacity as sovereign creators of our government and its constitution, solemnly declare that we seek a greater role in our self-governance beyond that of merely voting and giving away our power to politicians on election day. We choose freedom, the right to participate in the central power of government, the right to initiate and vote on laws in partnership with those we elect to our governing legislative bodies. As sovereign human beings, we have the innate right to collectively make majoritarian decisions on the policies that affect our lives. We the people recognize that elected officials at all levels of American government have no incentive to share legislative power with the people. Therefore, we pledge our efforts for as long as it takes to circumvent government inertia by directly voting to enact as the law of the land the National Initiative for Democracy. This federal ballot initiative amends the Constitution in a manner similar to the precedent set in Article 7. It creates an electoral trust, separate from representative government, to implement on behalf of the people legislative procedures established in an accompanying federal statute. The enactment of the national initiative essentially creates a legislature of the people in every government jurisdiction of the United States, operating in a legislative partnership with the elected federal, state, and local legislative bodies. Enacting the national initiative in the United States, or for that matter, in any country, continues the major advances in direct democracy begun by the Swiss in 1848 and improved upon when copied by 24 American states and hundreds of American local communities over the last 100 years. The global impact of empowering people to vote directly on public policies that affect their lives will change forever the paradigm of human governance, a goal worthy of pledging our lives, our property, and our sacred honor.
I would like to thank everyone for spending their day with me. I hope you have a wonderful Independence Day weekend.